Iran's anti-government protests extend into their fourth month. A VOA Persian senior anchor tells us about the latest tactics used by the protesters to defy Islamist rule.
As the videos coming in the last 24 to 48 hours are showing, this movement is still very much alive and people are fighting back against crackdown.
Plus, we'll get a behind-the-scenes look at how Iranian activists mobilized international support for a UN vote that expelled Iran from the World Body's Commission on Women's Rights.
A few of these Iranian women took a couple weeks meeting particularly those countries where we thought that they would either abstain or were on the fence.
And later in the program, we'll look at what's happened to Iran's morality police force that drew global outrage for its role in sparking the nationwide protests. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning, I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Iran's more than three-month-long protest movement is drawing inspiration from some detained activists who have made peaceful gestures of defiance while under severe pressure from the authorities. One of those activists is a 17-year-old girl detained last month in the western town of Abdenan, where she was forced to confess, say rights activists, to making Molotov cocktails and writing anti-government slogans. They say Sonia Sharifi was charged with enmity against God, a charge carrying the death penalty. When she was released on bail on December 15th, this is how locals greeted her. That was sound from a video posted online by an Iranian rights group and shared with me by VOA Persian senior journalist Siamak Deganpour. I spoke to him by phone Tuesday about why he thought the clip was interesting.
Thank you for having me, Michael. Sonia Sharifi, so she was in a bad situation inside the prison, and then for some reason under pressure, international pressure, they were trying to get her out of the jail on bail, on a very costly bail. And then you see the reaction. And what is very interesting is herself seeing, you see it in the video, she's standing on top of a car, raising both her hands to signify the victory. I mean, this is the generation this government is facing.
So some of the protesters have not been as fortunate as her, and many are still imprisoned. Some are even facing the death penalty. Why do you think she was able to get out?
As I mentioned, she was released on bail, so it's not like she's free. There are cases, other cases that the government's doing this sometimes because maybe they are under international pressure, releasing some people, arresting others. So they kind of playing with the mindset of people, sometimes showing their willingness. And as I probably you know that the reactions specifically from Western governments been severe, especially against what is happening on the women. So maybe there are cases that they don't want to go, did the same thing with two others, with Mohsen Shekari and Majid Reza Rahnavard, the same thing doing with Sonia Sharifi, which is a teenager.
Right. Well, those two names that you just mentioned, those were the first two protesters to have been executed since the protests began. How have people in Iran reacted to the threat of more protesters being executed like those two?
You know, the government has not been able to put an end to this movement. Protesters are employing different tactics. They keep writing anti-regime slogans on walls, hanging anti-regime posters over bridges. There is a campaign of people trying to draw their assets from banks. So they're doing everything they can. There are also reports of more strikes by workers in the industrial sectors. So the government is trying to keep people away from the street. But as the videos coming in the last 24 to 48 hours are showing in Kurdistan, Sistan-Baluchistan, cities of Rasht, Mashhad, Qom, Bushehr, Yazd, Hamadan, Tehran, and Karaj, and many other cities, that this movement is still very much alive and people are fighting back against crackdown. And I'm sure you've seen some of the videos they put besiege bases on fire and some of these supreme leaders' offices on fire as well.
So it seems the executions have not scared too many people away from showing defiance toward the regime. When it comes to Rakhnavard, he was the second man to be executed. He did have some final words in a video in which he was surrounded by his executioners. Let's have a listen to that video clip for a few seconds. So, Siamak, can you share with our audience what message Rakhnavard was trying to give to people, you know, as he was facing his very difficult final moments?
In the video that you just aired, the clip of it, which went viral, Majid Reza is blindfolded and surrounded by these guards and executioners, and was asked on camera by a government agent what he wished for his memorial, which is very cruel. And he answered he wanted people to be happy and sing a happy song on his grave and not to read prayers or Quran for him. And the government, as you know, has been trying to portray this revolution as an anti-Islam movement to divide people. But the positive reactions to Majid Reza comments and public condemnation of the regime's inhuman treatment of protesters has been unbelievable. So this is a very significant clip that was very much in the discussion in the past few days on social media.
Siamak Deganpour, senior anchor and producer for VOA Persian, thank you very much for joining me on Flashpoint Iran from Northern Virginia.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael.
Rights activists in the Iranian diaspora achieved a big win last week when the UN's Economic and Social Council voted to expel Iran from the UN Commission on the Status of Women. Since UN members elected Iran to the commission in April 2021, those activists campaigned to reverse the move, citing Tehran's poor women's rights record. That campaign intensified after Iran began cracking down on the nationwide protests that started in September. One of the women involved in that campaign is Nazanin Afshinjam McKay, an Iranian-born Canadian. I spoke to her by phone and asked her how it felt to hear about the Iranian government's expulsion from the commission.
I was celebrating like you can't imagine. I had just landed from a flight from Vancouver on a panel on Iran I had there back in Nova Scotia, and I was so eager for the plane to land because I needed to know the results. And the people around me must have thought I was crazy because they heard a shriek come out of my mouth. It was very exciting because a lot of people have been fighting for this for a long time. People from within Iran, Iranians on the outside of Iran, and even non-Iranian organizations have been pushing for this result.
Were you in touch with any of your fellow activists who were actually in the room on that day, and what did they tell you?
Yes, they were giving me live feeds of what was happening. When I landed, I got bing, 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 and I could see, you know, pictures of the screen of, you know, how many people voted, how many abstained, their personal reactions, the tears coming from their eyes, and just the celebration afterwards. They said I was missed, and I wish I could have been there hugging them. But it was exciting, you know, seeing them there and being able to enjoy that moment.
What can you tell our listeners about the role that you played and your fellow female activists who were at the UN on that day? What role did all of you play in mobilizing international support for the outcome of this vote?
Well, when Iran was first elected on this board, at that very day, I had put pressure on the United Nations to reconsider their vote. I posted things on social media back in April in 2010. I'd been working alongside an organization called UN Watch for many years. They monitor these kinds of injustices and put a lot of pressure as well. And make it known internationally.
Yeah, I saw that the head of UN Watch, Hillel Noyer, did give you a shout out after the vote.
Yes, we worked very well together for years. Since I think 2009, we've been working together to try to condemn Iran for their human rights abuses. And, you know, we think that it's a farce to put these dictatorial regimes on such elevated bodies. They shouldn't be given this platform. And in particular, a country that is one of the worst offenders of human rights and women's rights on the planet, where they're ranked 143 out of 146 on the gender gap index, to then be elected on such a body is a farce, and it delegitimizes the good work of the United Nations. And also, for the sake of the United Nations, if they want to continue to purport that they stand for the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, then they must abide by their own teachings.
Were you and your fellow activists able to, you know, beyond post messages on social media, actually talk to the international diplomats, the government officials who are, you know, responsible for taking these votes? And how would you describe those interactions?
Yes, I should give you more detail on kind of from beginning to end. Now, as part of the coalition of Iranian women who decided to take a strong stance on this, when we first got together in September after Mahsa Amini's death, we decided that this was something that we could fight on, even though it was unprecedented and it seemed like an impossibility. We thought, you know, if we put enough effort and international attention, then anything is possible. So this group of Iranian activists and diaspora members decided to first write a petition. And that petition we posted in a 2-page ad in the New York Times. And behind the scenes, we collected signatories from, you know, very high profile signatories, whether they were politicians, ex-politicians, or just people with a lot of clout. We had, you know, Michelle Obama, Hillary Clinton, Oprah Winfrey, Malala, and the list goes on. I had members of parliament from Canada sign on, including our foreign affairs minister, Melanie Joly. She agreed to sign. And just little by little, we collected these names, and we also had that printed in that 2-page ad. We had an online petition where we collected signatures, and we ended up collecting over 100,000 signatures. And in a second part, we had an exhibition, an art installation at Four Freedoms Park in New York, overlooking the United Nations. And the theme was Eyes on Iran.
Were you actually able to get UN diplomats to go in there and see that?
We had probably every media outlet you can imagine videotaping this exchange, this panel, and the art and the Iranian artists that showcased their arts there. We had congressmen and women there. There was so many people invited that I don't know if there was specific ambassadors there, but we did follow it up. A few of these Iranian women took a couple of weeks meeting with different delegations, meeting particularly those countries where we thought that they would either abstain or were on the fence. And they sat with them and explained to them why it was important for them to vote in this regard.
Well, I was going to ask, you know, we had 24 countries either abstain or vote against expelling Iran from the commission. What did you and your fellow activists try to say to them? And, what was the response from those who didn't end up, you know, agreeing with you?
Yes, well, I wasn't present in those meetings. They gave me some follow-up, but they all were very intent on listening, and they agreed that this Islamic regime is terrible when it comes to women's rights. And there were some that, you know, we thought they would vote in a certain manner, and they decided to abstain, which was very heartbreaking and disheartening. You know, for example, Mexico didn't vote in favor, and we were really disappointed because the group of women had met with them and had explained the reasons why Iran should not be, I should rephrase that, why the Islamic Republic of Iran should not be on the Commission for the Status of Women.
Well, what do you plan to do next with your activism when it comes to holding Iran accountable for the brutal crackdown on the protests?
Well, I continue to use my social media feeds to raise awareness on what's happening day by day. I continue to pressure my members of parliament to particularly list the IRGC in its entirety on the terrorist list here in Canada. They've done a good first job at sanctioning 10,000 IRGC members. They've put, I think, $74 million towards managing those sanctions. And they individually condemn those that continue to abuse human rights in Iran. But we would like to see the whole IRGC on the terrorist list, minus those, of course, that have been conscripted forcibly. We also continue to pressure them to apply Magnitsky sanctions. And I'm working with various members of the Iranian community and Member of Parliament Ali Esasi and Senator Ratna Omidvar to create this interparliamentary group, Friends of Iran, who would pressure for the seizing of assets of regime officials and repurposing them either to victims of this regime or in a manner that will help this revolution forward.
Well, international human rights activist Nazanin Afshinjan McKay, thank you so much for being with us on Flashpoint Iran from Nova Scotia.
Thank you very much for taking an interest and continuing to advocate for the voices of Iranian people. It's through media outlets like yours that does make a difference and keeps Iranian political prisoners alive and draws hope and gives hope to those on the inside of Iran to continue with their good fight.
After that interview, I asked Mexico's embassy in Washington why the nation abstained in the UN vote. In an email, it said Mexico believes the withdrawal of member states from multilateral fora does not contribute to dialogue, international cooperation, or the empowerment of women. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. Earlier this month, Iran's Attorney General Mohammad Jafar Montazeri caused confusion when he told reporters that Iran's morality police have been shut down. The morality police gained international notoriety in September when they detained Mahsa Amini, a 22-year-old Iranian Kurdish woman in Tehran, for allegedly not wearing her hijab strictly according to Islamic rules. Rights activists said the morality police beat Amini before she died in police custody days later. Since Montazeri's comment, there has been no government confirmation of the morality police disbanding or stopping their regular patrols of Iranian streets in their white and green vans. So what is the current situation of the force? I put that question by phone to Mahmoud Amiri Moghaddam, director of the Iran Human Rights Group.
So the status of the morality police, you know, it has been observed in some places and in many places, especially larger cities, it hasn't been seen. I think the main reason for that is that they don't want to trigger more anger, the regime. Because now it has been, you know, 3 months, despite the massive violence Iranian regime has been using against the protesters. The protests continue one way or other, and the regime is very cautious not to trigger more anger and make more people coming out. And I think that that could be one of the reasons why we don't see it so much, because they haven't stopped oppressing, they haven't stopped shooting at people or arresting peaceful protesters. So it's not about any kind of reform. You know, as I said, morality police was just one way of oppressing people. And in a totalitarian system, you know, it's not just enough to control the political power or freedom of expression. They interfere in people's most private aspects of life, and they have their own forces to do that.
Could I ask you to share some examples of the places in Iran where the morality police officers have been less observed in recent weeks?
Well, in larger cities like Tehran, you know, their presence has been less reported to us. You know, we are not everywhere, so we cannot say. But actually, from none of the large cities, it has been observed to the same extent. And then we have few reports saying that they have been observed. But again, in the best case, it could be about either reorganizing these forces or just keeping those cars away, because it's about the cars, the green and white cars with the people sitting in them. But the same people can be involved in oppressing, in the crackdown elsewhere.
What is your thought about more images that are coming from cities like Tehran showing women walking around without hijabs on and freely, you know, exposing their hair in public? Is that another indication that either the morality police are not around or the citizens just aren't afraid or don't care about them anymore?
Yes. So this is the way they show their anger and disobedience to the regime. I mean, as you said, in many Iranian cities, we have talked to people who have never been involved in politics, and they say that we just don't care. It's not because the morality police is not there. It's because it is their, let's say, most peaceful way of showing their opposition and challenging the authority. You probably have also seen many videos and pictures where pictures of the supreme leader is set on fire or torn apart. You know, that would have been impossible just for a few years ago. You know, it by itself could have led to death penalty. But, you know, it's happening everywhere. So back to this hijab. Right now, the regime is fighting for its survival. They don't have forces, you know, to control basically every movement people do, what they eat, what they wear. Right now, they are trying to survive. They are trying to control the worst protests. So it might seem that they don't care, but actually they don't have the possibility of, you know, arresting thousands of women every day.
It's like mass disobedience that they can't cope with.
They can't do that, and right now it's not their priority. So right now they are trying to build up this barrier of fear that has fallen down since the beginning of the protests. And what they do is the death sentences, executions, and I think this is their plan. Of course, if they ever manage to get control, then we will see all these oppressive forces back, and maybe even harder.
Mahmoud Amiri Moghaddam, Director of Iran Human Rights in Oslo, thank you so much for being with us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael.
That brings us to the end of this week's program. There's more VOA coverage of Iran 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and on our social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. I'm Michael Lippin. On behalf of the Flashpoint Iran team, thank you for listening, and we invite you to join us again next week.